My name is Arnie Ohox, and I'm going to be the moderator for this forum this evening. I'm going to be at the village for 2 weeks, and will be moderating a number of forums in that time. I would invite you, as a part of your stay at Holden and a part of your involvement, to please give me feedback in terms of the forums that we offer and that we run. And also, please feel free to speak to me about ideas you may have for other forums during your stay at Holden. Forums are that time at Holden that we try to set aside to encourage as much possible direct conversation among villagers as possible, slightly different from the teaching sessions in the sense that there is no instructor in charge doing a major portion of presentation. Rather, we hope to introduce a topic or a question about which you have some interest in sharing ideas or asking some questions. We can engage in that kind of conversation. The topic this evening is crime and community, the fear factor, and that is a topic that we hope will generate some interest this evening and also generate some interest in your participation in some of the other sessions that are being presented during the rest of the week. The person who will be with me this evening as a resource person and will make a few introductory remarks after I do is Dan Lewis, who is with us this week from Chicago. He is our, Jody, you called him our criminologist in residence. Dan has a background in terms of research and working with the subject that I think will enable him to throw out some interesting and provocative ideas for us. The reason for the choice of topic, for one, it's a topic that permits us to use some of the resources we have in the village at this time, Dan being one. There are others who have had experience working in the area of crime, criminal justice, this kind of a thing, which will relate some of the legal implications of that. And there are sessions this week that relate to that area. So we thought it was, first of all, a topic that would make use of resources that we have. Second reason for choosing it in my mind was to try and relate to what Holden as a village and a community is trying to do this summer, and that is to get us to reflect in a number of ways on this interesting two-word concept that's the theme for the summer, and that is gentle justice. And I've only been here a couple days now, and I've already discovered that virtually everyone I have talked to has a different idea about just what gentle justice might mean, what it means to them. And I was reflecting on that, and I realized that regardless of how difficult it is for us to maybe pin down justice in any technical kind of a sense, most of us relate very well to justice in our own personal lives on a very direct, simple level. I think most of us know when we feel that we've been wronged. And it doesn't matter whether that fits anybody's definition of justice or not, but I know when I've been done wrong. And I think in our lives and community, crime is the one thing that engenders more of a response of having been wronged than perhaps anything else. One of the things that I hope this forum will do is give you a chance to reflect on your own experiences and feelings in this area a little bit, and share some of those, and use the forum time and discussion to see where we're at, what we're experiencing in our own lives, our attitudes, our changes of behavior, or what is crime or fear of crime doing to our attitudes and to our life together in community. Quickly, a couple of ground rules. Forums are set to be an hour long, so I will officially close this forum at 10 o'clock, regardless of what might be going on in terms of conversation or discussion. You're always free, of course, to stay after, but we do want to respect that time limit that we set for ourselves. Also, we hope that you appreciate it as a time to share your own feelings and thoughts and ideas. and to listen to others. We do not try to achieve any kind of a consensus during a forum in terms of trying to convince others to agree with our opinion or to use it as a time to teach others the truth of our position. Rather, it's a time of sharing. So we're interested in having you talk about what your experiences have been, what you think and what you feel, and hearing one another out in that context. A couple questions to maybe jog your thinking a little bit in this whole area of crime and community, the fear factor. Is it just from your own experience, wherever you're living, whatever your environment is at home, is to just reflect a little bit in terms of how safe do you feel? Do you feel safe where you live with the things that go on day to day for you? What are the things that frighten you or scare you? What are the things that make you feel unsafe if that's the case? And then what are you doing about those fears? I think that's an interesting thing for us to look at. Are there changes you are aware of in yourself if you look back several years? Are you doing things differently for yourself or for your home or your family or your children or your parents or whatever differently now than you were not too long ago? And what has brought about those changes? Also, attitude changes. Are you aware of any attitude changes either in yourself or in people around you toward the safety of your own life or where you live or the safety of your community? And what do you see people around you doing in response to their experiences of where they're at? And as we talk together, I would hope that we can start maybe discussing or sharing with each other feelings about what responses or attitude changes that we're maybe aware of, which ones are appropriate and which ones are not appropriate, and what are our responses maybe doing to us as people and as a community. Are they justified in light of what's actually taking place or not? So those are some of the things that I would see as open game for this kind of forum. A lot of options come, conversation I think could go a number of different ways in this area. I think that's all I have by way of introductory remarks. Dan, turn it over to you for some. Dan has agreed to simply share a number of things that might jog our thinking and pique our interest a little bit. I found some of those things kind of interesting.
I'm delighted to be here. I brought with me a report called a Report to the Nation on Crime and Justice by the U.S. Department of Justice, and I was showing it to Arnie this morning, and there's a map on the front that shows the darker the color, the more crime there is in the area, and I looked up here by Holden, and this part of Washington has one of the highest crime rates in the country. And here I am out in this beautiful part of the country, and my federal government is telling me I'm in one of the most dangerous spots. And that doesn't jive with my experience in the last couple of days. So what does that mean? What does it mean? I occasionally give talks, and here's a cover of U.S. News and World Report that says, "Fear stalks the streets. Newsweek, epidemic of violent crime," with a picture of a gun pointing at you. "The curse of violent crime," on the cover of Time from a couple of years ago, with a gun and a sort of skeletal kind of person there. So the crime issue and how we know about it is part of our everyday lives through the media and through the kinds of knowledge that's being produced by researchers like myself and the federal government. The issue is a complicated one. I didn't think that 10 years ago when I got into it. I thought it was pretty simple when I got into it. What makes people afraid? Crime. The more crime you experience, the more afraid you're going to be. People who experience lots of crime will be more afraid than people who don't experience lots of crime. What's the big deal? It's simple and direct. What do you want to do about it? Well, let's get more police. Let's get stiffer penalties for people that commit crimes. and let's keep those people in prisons for longer times. And that, in fact, is what we've done in this country in the last 7 or 8 years. I mentioned to a couple of you that I've seen since I got here that there are more people incarcerated in prisons in the United States now than any time in our history. One man in every 35 is in jail. We are spending more on our prisons than we ever have before. The crime rate, which is always a tricky thing to kind of measure, does seem to be going down. So maybe that scenario that I laid out is correct. When people like me do research on it, though, we find a very different thing. There are some paradoxes that might trigger some of your thinking tonight, both about your own experiences and about what we might do about this problem. The most scared people in the United States are the least victimized. Women and the elderly are by and large the most fearful, and men and young men are the least fearful. The most victimized groups, the people against whom crimes are committed the most, are young black males. And they're the least afraid. So right from the beginning, there's something going on here that's not as simple as what I laid out at the beginning. Older white and black women are the most afraid and the least victimized. So the crime equals fear notion, calculation, equation may not be the right place to start. People who have never been victimized, who have never experienced crime, are often just as afraid as the people that have experienced crime. So that may not have something to do with it. So the question of what makes you afraid, maybe it's seeing things like this. Maybe it's things that have happened to your neighbors. And occasionally, it's the things that have happened to you. But it's a more complicated question than the kind of simple, direct notion that I laid out to you that I started with 10 years ago in looking at this issue. We're not afraid of holding. It's probably the one place on earth where it doesn't cross our mind that something bad could happen to us. And there are plenty of reasons that are related to community that may be the key to trying to understand the issue. People here share certain values, at least we assume they do. People here are like us. We look around the room. Remember when I first moved to Evanston, just outside of Chicago, I got on the bus one day and I felt very uncomfortable. I couldn't figure out what the reason was. And I realized that everybody on the bus was just like me. Whereas in Chicago, everybody was different from me. And that made me feel better. So there are issues about community and similarity and common values that are related to fear in ways that aren't as simple as the way that I first mentioned. And that may be just all I want to say at this point.
Thanks for those comments, Dan. Any responses to some of the things that Dan has thrown out or to some initial sharings? I'm curious just to hear some of you reflect on what you perhaps have experienced in your own life or in your own community. I know that in the last year, I'm aware of the first major security system having gone in our block. And
why?
Pardon?
Why?
It's a house that is next to an open field that happens to be a pathway for a lot of people going from a neighborhood over to a shopping area. And I think this was about the third time in 2 years that they had break-ins that were, in a sense, more nuisance than anything, but they were break-ins, and that, you know, the response was one to try to protect then the sanctity of the home. Bit directly related to specific experiences of that home having been violated. It's private space having been violated. Yes?
I've kind of had some interesting experiences in the last year. We moved from a small rural town to Denver. In that rural town, we never locked our cars. rarely locked her house, but then we also had a dog carrying her all the time. She was in the house by, unless she went past the dog. But it wasn't a big deal. And when we moved to Denver, we were a bit concerned because the person that we bought the house from had been burglarized 3 times in about 3 years. And they were the only person on the block that had been burglarized. It was kind of a similar situation that you just talked about. At first, we always kept the front door locked. You know, it's got the burglar bars on it a little bit. And the other door behind it locked. And there were 3 locks on that door, so it was like getting into Fort Knox. You know, every time you go in and out. And after a while, we got tired of that. And so now we only have the one door locked. And we're real conscious of it. I mean, I've never been burglarized. But we always keep that door locked. And we always have a lot of activity. Right now, we've got somebody's house sitting in front, even though we've got a dog in the backyard. And that's just, you know, one of the things we've done. Even though none of our neighbors have been burglarized, sure, I'm doing, I think, sometimes more than I need to do out of what you talk about. Fear. You know, but part of that is, my fear is that I work with juvenile delinquents who commit crimes. So I'm real aware of the types of crimes that are frequently done. And I think part of my concern, over concern, which is just job related, I just see so much in the way of people who commit crimes, you know, who want their life. They're really nice people.
Nothing recent for me, but I grew up in a situation in an urban area in Brooklyn where I never saw anybody victimized. Took the subway to high school for 4 years. Feel very much at home when I'm back there now. I have never had any fear for my life. A humorous side, a number of years ago when I was working as a camp counselor in a church camp upstate New York, we had some kids from the South Bronx that were up there. And this was, I think, for this one particular group, the first time they were out of the Bronx. The first night, they asked me if there were locks for the tent. And I think it was hooking on what you said, when you were on a bus, and it was a different situation. It's an unknown, and they weren't used to that. Maybe I've used the word just precaution. I can be hip and say street savvy that you don't look for it, but I've never been fearful of it, and it's something I've grown up with. I had a steel door in the apartment house where I grew up, and 2 locks on that, and then a lock to get into the entryway. And that was the way it was. And we did it.
May I ask Dan a question?
Yes.
Dan, there's a old saw that says familiarity breeds contempt, which I guess means that if you get accustomed enough to something, you don't fear it anymore. I wonder if in your study or research you've played with the idea at all that people who live constantly with crime develop sort of a contempt for it, its threat, just the way a person working with a power tool after a while is apt to get careless, whereas someone who's never worked one is pretty cautious when they first approach the thing.
I think it depends on the kind of community that we're talking about. In some communities, things are so bad. There in Chicago, we have a series of housing projects that houses 20,000 people in one row of 12, 15-story buildings. And to get in, you have to be very, very poor. And it's sort of the last place anybody wants to end up in terms of where they live. And the crime rates in those areas are fantastically high. And people, while they're used to it, so perhaps their fear levels aren't as high, are very concerned and are very aware of the risks that they experience. And I think one of the things that happens when you get in the business of thinking about this is that you begin to distinguish visceral emotional feelings from cognitive, knowledge-based feelings, where where you know you have certain risks in certain part of town that you don't have in another part of town. So that where the fear may be reduced in some areas because crime is a constant thing, the awareness of it and the kinds of precautions that you take doesn't make you sloppy. I mean, you're still careful about where you go and who you're familiar with and what kinds of situations to try to avoid. The gentleman that was talking about moving to Denver, there's another kind of familiarity there that I think has a different sort of dynamic, which is any place where you're a stranger and you don't know what to expect from people, you're going to be more worried. So that as you become familiar with people around you, to the extent that they're not in the business of ripping off houses, would be the extent to which you become less fearful about them. So that one of the things, I mean, I suspect some of you are in these, there's been a great boom in kind of block clubs and block watches and eyes on the street, we call it surveillance in the business, where people look out for each other. One of the real pluses of that kind of activity is just to know the guy that lives next door, because he's been there for 15 years and you've never more than nodded to him before. And the block club allows you to find out a little bit more about him and see him in another light where, again, you can see what you share. And that often is very helpful. So the familiarity with those around you, where they become less strangers, can help. And familiarity with the risks can also help in terms of being more streetwise or careful about what you do. The sad part of it is, I think maybe my spouse will, Stephanie, will talk about this in some of her sessions, is that for women it's a very different situation. The feelings of vulnerability, the kinds of risks that lots of women feel are tremendously heightened. And men and women are sort of in different worlds when it comes to this often. Because men are socialized to think that they can take care of themselves and they know how to handle situations, at least know when to run and can run away, you know. Women often feel much more vulnerable and much more afraid. And it pervades huge parts of their lives and often constricts who they see, where they go, how they get there, what they do. In ways that reduces the quality of life tremendously. And some of the activities that I have been involved in have worried more about the fear factor than they worry about the crime factor. I mean, a gentleman that's in the, works with the juveniles could probably attest to this, that, you know, often these kids that get involved in this stuff do it on the spur of the moment. If they can't get into one house, they'll pick another house. It's very hard to do something about that from a police standpoint. But you can do something about the fear. You can get to know your neighbors. You can do certain kinds of things that will reduce the possibilities that it'll be your house that's burglarized. And all of that, I think, helps. And I suspect that, you know, some people in this room are in programs like that or aware of them in their neighborhoods, because they've popped up all over the country in the last 7 or 8 years.
How successful are the neighborhood watch groups?
Well, it's interesting. Jody and I were talking about different kinds of knowledge tonight. The personal knowledge, the storytelling knowledge that Walt was describing versus the kind of social science-y knowledge that someone like me is about. And we're just not very good at assessing these things very well. And the better the job we think we're doing of evaluating them, the less likely we're going to show an effect. Whereas someone who's experiencing the block watch will swear by it. And when somebody goes in and observes and tries to find the change, it's very difficult to do. So the bottom line is it's hard to find positive effects of them, although people that are in them feel very good about it.
You described our experience. We raised our family in the central city, highest crime rate in the city, and burglarized ones. But then the foolish thing, and I think the benefit for our family is that they learn to grow up without fear. I think they're going to live anywhere. as a benefit. But as you say, you do have to watch and be cautious about certain things. I understand, of course.
The media plays an interesting role. It'd be interesting to me. One of the reasons I brought these is that so many people get their fear from what the TV is saying or reading some terrible, you know, newspaper undoubtedly has some terrible.
The TV fair is terrible for the children. They grew up with the world that they are afraid of.
And it's always a stranger or an unknown or an irrational kind of act. And that feeds into our worst fears, especially when we don't know people around us. That we just don't trust them. We don't know how they're going to react. That it's random, that it's irrational. The terrorism thing is interesting sort of extension of that into the international world. One of the reasons I think it's so upsetting to people is because it's random, you know. You didn't do anything. You didn't make a mistake. You weren't doing something you ought not to have done. You just got picked up by chance.
It seems to me that a significant amount of the crime that we experience, though, is crime within the range of relationships we have. I've worked at the juvenile court in Snohomish County here in Washington, and I know that the third most frequently referred offense that we have for juveniles is for domestic violence, simple assault, where the offender is, or the offender and the victim are in the same household. So to me, I guess I look at the crime problem from a little bit different perspective. On the ground that I think that we're a much more violent culture than we pretend to be, and that the violence is not without, but unfortunately is very often within our home. And I think that the views of spouse abuse, child abuse, child sexual abuse, that those are issues that occur right under our noses, and that for literally generations we have ignored, and the violent crime, at least some of the reports that I've read, that a high percentage of the murders that occur are between people of the same race, and in most instances between people that know each other and are involved in some type of argument or getting. Yeah.
That's a very good point. That it's not just murders. Like the race thing is an important thing to bring up too. Most crimes against blacks are committed by blacks, about 80%, and most crimes against whites are committed by whites, about 70%. So that a lot of what's going on in the sort of normal criminal activity, not the Bundys and not these kinds of things, are between people who know each other and live in the same area, and are involved in the nastiest kind of ways of relating to each other, which leads to lots of terrible things happening. I mean, we're used to thinking that it's black on white. We're used to thinking that it's irrational and we don't know the person. And overwhelmingly the story, I mean, I don't know about your house with the three break-ins, but I was sort of smiling myself because it's probably the kid next door, you know.
Well,
yeah. Who was doing it, and that's true of so much of this stuff, that there are connections, there are links, and those links lead to the criminal activity, and I mean, in my life, that's not the case, or at least I don't know, I mean, people in my neighborhood, I don't think took my radio out of my new Toyota 12 hours after I got the car, certainly in lots of more urban kinds of community, it is the case. And the person you have to be the most worried about may be in the next bedroom or may just live up the street. And that's different from how most of us experience.
I'd like to share just a very interesting conversation I had recently with someone, and I'm not sure exactly what it says, but I think it's relevant to the discussion here. I think it says something. You can help me with what, but this person shared that they were ambivalent about the question of, you know, this fear of crime and what you do because of the fear and to protect yourself, She said she and her husband, they have a handgun in the house. And they bought this not too long ago. And she said she feels good knowing that it's in the house, even though she's aware that she probably couldn't use it. But it made her feel safe. She said, we do, however, keep the gun in a room at one end of the house and the magazine in another room at the other end of the house. So that way, if it ever comes up to using it, we have to go to a lot of effort to get the two together. And she was open enough to share. She said, you know, not long ago, I was glad that we had the two separated. Because she said, we got into a very violent argument. And she said, I believe that if I had access to that gun, I would have killed my husband. And yet, she says, I still feel good knowing that it's in the house. And it made a point. You know, there's something there with the fear and the security kind of a thing. And yet, you know, she recognized the real ambivalence in there, too.
I'd like to share an experience that I've had with he was a murderer. And at that time, who remembers the Kenneth Bianchi trials that they had? Well, he was in Bellingham, and he was working on a work release or something, staying at the Lighthouse Mission. And one day, I went down to visit a friend of mine who was ill. And when I came into the yard, I just go into the house. I don't even knock on the door. And I went into the house. I didn't find anyone in there. So I came out again, and there was a man working in the yard doing gardening. And I had asked if Ellen and Marvin were here. No, they'd gone over town to go and see the doctor. And I said, how long ago? Well, it's quite a while. I said, you think they'll be home soon? I think so. He said, why don't you come in the house and sit there and talk to me? So I did. I talked to that man for an hour and a half, and that was Kenneth Bianchi. 2 weeks later, he murdered two of the girls from our Western Washington University. And the funny thing, last summer when I was here, we had a session in here, and this man that was the leader had a shirt that said Bianchi on it. After the session was over, I went up to him and I said, boy, are you wearing that shirt? Well, he says, why shouldn't I? I said, that's the name of an outstanding murderer here in this country. It is? And I said, haven't you heard of Bianchi? No. Well, maybe he hadn't, but Bianchi was killing women all over the country. But here I sat an hour and a half and talked to a murderer less than 2 weeks after he killed two women. Now, I said, the good Lord must have been with me. And before I got, then when I left, then those two women were at home. He followed me out to the car, and I thought, is he going to come in my car? I didn't know who he was. But that was Kenneth Bianchi, and that was a nasty guy. But the fellow that was leading this session, that I questioned his shirt, I didn't see him wear it the rest of the time. Last year, we had that.
Did he talk about anything to you that would have led any hints to his problems? And
he was a nice man to talk to, and just as polite as could be. And nothing. Well, I never had a dream that there was anything wrong with him because he was a polite man. And then when less than 2 weeks later, he killed these two girls. And was on the same side of the town where I lived and where I've been down to see these friends of mine, too.
Yes.
You know, I just want to say, I don't know about anyone else, but just talking about this, I start getting this fear welling up inside me and thinking about, what are the other people in the room like? You know, maybe it's just maybe it's just conditioning or something. You know, I live near Chicago, and I would not move into Chicago because a girl that I went to high school with, a week after she moved downtown, she was murdered and her disappeared and was never found. A lady that I worked with's husband, they lived in Rogers Park, he was stabbed 5 times. I don't know how he lived. But I mean, you know, those kinds of things, it brings up such a fear where you start to doubt everyone that's around you. And until this, I'm sure an hour after we're done, I'll trust everybody again.
T-shirt.
It's funny.
I see Stephanie in the corner. When we were doing some of this research together, she and a woman named Margaret Gordon that was here a couple weeks ago looked particularly at the woman's beer issue. And in doing so, everybody on that research staff that was a woman was terribly nervous a month after getting into it. I mean, it's almost one of these things where you don't want to talk about it because it starts to, well, maybe I should be worried. I mean, maybe I'm not taking enough precautions. And one of the reasons that people use the kind of scare tactics that they use is to sort of play on that fear in order to get you to a meeting or get you to vote for somebody or so forth and so on. So you have to kind of, at least I mean, everybody's different, but you have to try to calibrate in yourself the kind of intensity of the feelings and then try to identify what's triggering it. I mean, running into somebody like that, I mean, that's a one in a million kind of situation that's going to stay with you for the rest of your life in terms of taking a careful look at strangers that you talk to, especially the polite ones. And that's probably not bad, as long as it doesn't become overpowering, as long as it doesn't allow you to do the kinds of things and live the kinds of ways that you want to live. It's a balance. I don't think there's a right or wrong to it, and it depends on the kinds of places that you're living in, the communities that you're in. But it, I mean, one thing that I think it's important to bring out is one of the things that's wrong with thinking about it as something that somebody else is going to take care of for you, the police or stiffer penalties or politicians, is that it takes away from you a capacity to handle it somewhat yourselves. I mean, there are things you can do. You can be more careful. You can get to know your neighbors. You can join in some of these programs, and it does make a difference. And it's not just a matter of more cops and longer sentences, because even with those things around, the dynamics that produce guys like that are coming from other places in our society, and they will continue to be produced, and we need to keep ways to sort of balance our freedom with our need to control some of these risks.
A couple of years ago, I lived in Washington, D.C., in a community with three men and three women, and I found it interesting how much we as women always wanted doors locked and wanted to know where each other was all the time. And the men would walk out of the house and leave the front door standing open. And we finally sat down as a group to say, listen, we're scared, and this is why we're frightened. And the fear, most especially for each of us, of rape, was foremost in our mind. And afterwards, I also found out that the men became much more heightened in their fear for us, not for themselves. So I'd go out running, and they'd say, no, you shouldn't run there because last week there was a crime. And I never ran there again. And I found that the parameters that I had set for myself, instead of in terms of being somewhat streetwise, which I think I am, started becoming smaller and smaller and smaller, and how frustrating and angering that can be.
And also part of the motivation for coming to a place like this?
For me?
Yeah. It is for me. I guess that's why I'm staying here.
No, not for me. Although I did have an opportunity to do an internship in Brooklyn, New York, as a single woman, having to walk 1 mile to the parish, and found out from the man who was there 2 years ahead that there were always men standing on the street day and night. And that it was no problem for him because he'd wear a collar and they'd call him father. And I laughed, I said, that's great, but you know, what do they call me? The Virgin Mother? This doesn't work. And I didn't go there. And I went to New Jersey instead, to a upper middle class community, because of that fear. But then all the women in the church, most of the women, were afraid whenever I went into Manhattan or into the Bronx or anything else for my life or for my safety.
One of the interesting stories when we first started this research, you know, over 10 years ago, was we thought we knew what we were doing. And so we wanted to know what the crime problems were. And we were studying communities in Chicago, Philadelphia, and San Francisco that we selected.
So we did a bunch of interviews with people about what they thought the crime problems were in their area, and we expected to hear about rape and robbery and murder and so forth. And we go up to people and we say, now, can you tell us about the crime problems here? And they'd say, it's that graffiti. Or they say, and we say, no, we want to know about the crime problem. And they'd say, well, it's those abandoned buildings over there. And we'd say, no, seriously, tell us about the real crime problems. And they'd say, well, it's those kids hanging out on the corner, or it's those, I think they're taking drugs over there in the park. And what we picked up in some of the working class and poor neighborhoods is, sure, there was a concern about rape, robbery, and murder. But there was also a concern about what we call incivilities. These kinds of cues that give you the feeling that conventional standards aren't being upheld, and that if you see an abandoned building, or you see kids on a street corner, or you see kids drinking in the park, it's letting you know that the common value system isn't being upheld, and that makes people very nervous too. Those are also things that you can do something about. You can work with the kids. You can do something about the abandoned building. You can try to do something about some of the drug business. Those are things that you don't have to be a policeman in order to have some impact on. And when people worked on those kinds of issues, again, the murderers are tough, but when they worked on those kinds of issues, they could bring about some change. And getting to know those kids and finding a place for them to play basketball with, working on the abandoned buildings so that they were either torn down or renovated, working on the graffiti so that the kids were brought together to kind of wash the walls and to make it look nicer. All of those things gave you both a feeling of more community and did reduce the fear. I mean, it did make people feel better about their neighbors and about what was going on. So if you just, I mean, there are things to be afraid of, but there are also things that you can do something about that are actionable, that are part of this whole package. And in these urban neighborhoods, that those incivilities were often as much concern as crime problems as the rapes and the murder.
Now, it's always been a mystery to me why some people do what they do. And like the case that you brought up, sure, you thought he was a fine young man or whatever, and I've heard a lot of stories like that where a person like that will turn around and do something just crazy, way out of line. A fear that I've had is kind of right within myself, where for whatever reason in my upbringing I have experienced feelings of aggression and whatever, where it got to the point where I felt afraid of myself for what I might do. And please, you in the picture, don't be afraid of me.
You're probably right, Doug.
But I look at my upbringing and then think, somebody that has had a real rough upbringing, and I've worked the last few years with juvenile boys and see some pretty rough upbringings, and the things that must be going through their minds and the feelings of aggression that they must be experiencing, and if there's nowhere to go with that aggression, it just keeps building and building and building. And I think a big key to this whole thing is prevention and trying somehow to stop it before those aggressive feelings escalate. Now, how you point that out in people is a real difficult thing to deal with. But
you know, one of the interesting things about the differences between communities is that when you talk to people that come from less privileged neighborhoods, they worry about their own kids. They worry about it in terms of how they're bringing up their kids and how their neighbors are bringing up their kids, and not only the controlling of aggression, but the basic values that the kids are getting. When you talk to more middle-class people, they worry about it coming from the outside. They feel pretty comfortable with their own children and their own the people that are like them. And there's this real split between when you talk about prevention amongst the poor, they want to help their own children not go into a kind of criminal pattern. When you talk to people from more well-to-do areas, they want to talk about keeping people out that are going to be the ones that are going to cause the crime. And there's a real difference and how they think about the problems. And one of the things that's, at least remembering as the week goes on, and I did some of the sessions and some of the other sessions that go on, is that in all this concern about fear and in all this concern about the victim, some of which is tremendously good because the balance was tilted way the other way 10 or 15 years ago in terms of just worrying about the offender, we don't want to lose sight of injustice and inequality and some of the causal factors that make the kids that offend and do these bad things do them, because those factors are still there. There's nothing happening in the more police, stiffer sentences, more prisons that's going to stop those dynamics that produce those 15 or 16 year old kids from producing more of them. And I think one of the things that we need to balance in ourselves when we think about this thing is, you know, yes, the victim needs to have their place in terms of thinking about policy and what we ought to do, and they were overlooked for a long time, but let's not forget that the offender and the kid that's doing it does not have to be that way. And there are things you can do on that side too.
In your research, did you come up with any kind of statistics about the percentage of people incarcerated who did not do well in school?
Generally, people that end up in prisons didn't do very well in school, had poor achievement backgrounds, low educational attainments, come from broken and battered families. Who's there is who you expect to be there to a large extent. I mean, another interesting racial statistic, I mean, we're used to thinking about the prisons being all black, and more than 50% of the prison population is white. So that dynamic is working in the white community as well as the black community in terms of those factors. And we've tended to, you know, forget about those people and those factors in the last decade or so. I mean, it's not just Reagan and the more conservative spirit, it was coming before him too.
Where I worked in Colorado for a while, state prison, they did a study on the typical profile of the inmate that caused them the greatest management problems. And the greatest management problems usually centered around death, you know, where guys go kill people. And the typical inmate, in the order of preference, in the order of significance, the types of personalities and profiles that they had. Number one, they had more than a high school education, but less than a college education. They came from a middle class family, and they were usually white.
The other thing to remember about prisoners is they all get out. So the average length of stay is not that long. It's only about 3 years or so. And they're all coming back. And that's something to bear in mind. I don't know. We don't like to think about that. I mean, a lot of them end up back in prison after they get out, but they're out here causing lots of problems.
Recently, I found out something about how prisoners are treated at the Oak Park Heights prison near the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And they have groups of prisoners, and each one has an individual room, and they have a key. They carry on their own key and lock up their own room behind them, and then go in groups, do all their activities. And so the task is that this is one of their ways of trying to rehabilitate these people, is that they give them a sense of personal security, that they don't have to be afraid.
Yeah.
Be afraid that someone's going to come into their room or anything. And it seems that this is one of these inalienable rights of a person, that we should have the right to feel personally secure. If they ever could get prisoners to feel that they're personally secure inside a prison with all these others, why should we be afraid when we're not in any kind of situation like that at any time?
I'm currently being an expert witness for the state of Illinois on a case that's exactly like that, where a bunch of prisoners
brought suit against the state because they weren't safe in prison. There was so much victimization, and I mean, I'm on the side of the state, and we're trying to show that the state's doing the best it can. But one of the odd things about going into a prison that you've never been in one is how open it is. I mean, people aren't in their cells. There's tremendous movement around. I took a bunch of students down to Stateville last year, and it was like introducing honey into a beehive. I mean, there was this tremendous whir of activity around them, and it's an open system in which there's a lot of negotiation between the staff and the inmates about how to run the place in a way that's reasonable. I mean, it's not your notion of them, you know, being in the cell and being punished by the kind of isolation that they experience. It's very different. It's no fun, man.
Yeah, Billy. Just a word or two with my ex-journalist hat on here for a minute on the media question, Dan, which you really didn't pursue. There are some interesting studies about the production of crime waves by urban media in particular. And the results of the study seem to indicate that the production of crime waves has a lot to do with the internal dynamics at a particular newspaper and with the economics of that paper at a given time. Virtually nothing to do with what's actually going on in the crime statistics in the city at any given time. So it is one more hurdle, barrier, between us and figuring out what's actually going on in this area. It seems to me that newspapers are particularly bad sources of any accurate information. Another way in which that's true, it seems to me, is that newspapers, because of how they define news, generally take the exceptional case and play it as the story. And if you get enough exceptional cases strung together, you begin to think that that's normal, when in fact any sort of objective look at it tells you that that's not at all normal. Newspapers don't help.
Yeah. Can I ask Dan whether he had studied any prisoners like in Europe, like in Switzerland or anything like that? How do we, our prison, compare with them? And that's what's going on over there.
I have not done that kind of work, but it is fair. I mean, I always hate to mention this because it's such a grisly comparison, but we rank with South Africa and Russia as the three countries that imprison the most of our population. But I really haven't looked at comparative systems, and that's a real important thing to do because it gives us other ways to think about things than the ways we normally do.
When newspapers report crime, I think what you said is particularly true in the case of rape. In a study that we did, we found that newspapers reported 13 completed rapes to every one rape attempt that was thwarted, when in fact the real ratio is just the reverse. So if you read newspapers to get information about rape, the impression that you have is that it's impossible to resist rape, that you won't successfully resist rape, when in fact that's not the case in the real world. So rape stories particularly get played up when newspapers are having financial physical. They're good headlines that sell a lot of newspapers. And newspapers seem to like rape and have exotic or grisly details. And they always seem to report rapes that are completed. And they don't report stories where women successfully resist rape attempts.
I was going to ask Dan what he thought about the TV, whether that is having any effect on younger people.
It's a good question. Your guess is as good as mine. Social scientists spend huge amounts of time and money trying to figure that out. And, I mean, intuitively, it seems like it must. But that's
well,
all.
When you think, like, they spend millions for commercials, you know,
right.
Coca-Cola and all that, then you begin to wonder, if they're doing that for a 30-second commercial, it's to sell the public a particular thing.
Right.
And they have a story on TV that's violent. I wonder whether any of that is carried on to the kids.
Well, our 3.5-year-old, who's never had a toy gun, continually walked around with his finger out like this. Some of it's coming from aggression inside, but some of it's coming from watching
whatever on Saturday morning.
One quick comment in response to yours is television, you know, their violence in this, is it affecting the kids at all? I think for us it's just as important to ask, is it affecting us at all? And I guess that's where my question was, in terms of reflecting on our own lives and attitudes and beliefs. It's important to sense any kind of changes that we can be aware of in ourselves, where we're maybe being affected by how we think about our neighborhood, our neighbors, and our community. I live in Edmonds, north of Seattle. Do I think of Seattle as a safe city or not on the basis of what I watch on the TV news? That's just as important, I think, as to what's this news story doing to my kids. Will it make them more or less prone to violence, or dull their sensitivities or something like that? It shapes me too. Am I going to go to the Pike Street Market in Seattle if I feel it's unsafe because of, you know, news reports? And then the question of how accurate the choice of what to report and how often to report really becomes important.
One other fairly disturbing recent study asked a lot of people about certain events, whether or not they had seen those events in a dramatization on television or as part of the news. And the majority of people couldn't distinguish, could not tell you whether or not the event being described to them was first televised on the news or in a filtered news or something. Wow.
We have 3 minutes. It's just a warning, so that if some of you have been sitting on something that you are going to feel terribly bad about not contributing, you better speak now or...
As a woman, I think something also you said, mentioned fear, and I think there's the other side of that, and you also have anger as well as frustration at being limited and at having to be afraid. I mean, I've been at college now for 2 years, and I live on campus, and I grew up in Seattle, in the city, and we never really kept our doors locked or our car locked either, which probably was really stupid. Then when I got to the dorms, and of course on college campus, a stress on safety, and there are so many young people, and lots of females, and as far as race and being accosted and things like that, college campus often draw people, or at least draw attention to that. I think I always don't have to deal with that, because I found myself becoming afraid because of my roommate said, you know, well, look, when we go down the hall to the bathroom, we should lock our room because someone might come in and hide in our closet. And it does happen. I mean, that's the thing. This is the one next to us. Some guy came in to several times and tried to, hit some girl over the head and tried to rape him. And it wasn't successful. But, I mean, it happens enough that you do become afraid. But the other side of that, at least for me, is just this anger. And sometimes it's huge. And not just, it's frustration at feeling like I have to be careful and I have to take some risk when I go out. And also just anger that's not directed at all. Just anger at having to be afraid at all. And I think that's,
appreciate those comments. Just as a pitch for what's coming in the week, Stephanie is going to be dealing with that. One or two sessions, I believe?
Okay.
Two sessions on the whole question of women and anger. Maybe interested in that. Anybody want to make the concluding statement?
Fear not.
Fear not. As Wes Freed once said, the only thing we have to fear is bad popcorn.
Ted Bundy. He's in prison and he's studying all the time. He's been an attorney. Boy, he knows how to save his neck. And that's disgusting. I believe in capital punishment.
You're good. That's another form.
Yeah, right. 10 seconds late with that comment. Thank you, and thank you, Dan, especially.